Right? Good morning. So, did you all go to the office party yesterday? So how has Tech Ed been so far? Good Tech Ed? Bad Tech Ed? Would you like to go for another week? Or are you happy to go home today? I know that I am, but it's just because I'm getting old. So anyway, I'm probably here competing of the session that has the longest title at Tech Ed. So the session is Get Up and Get Ready for OneDrive. So my name is Kimmo Fors. I've been working with SharePoint since SharePoint Terms Team Services version 1, so ancient history. Been doing various roles within the company, being in consulting, helping large customers, being in the service team, actually delivering the cloud. I still have the placards on my wall, 100,000 seats in the cloud. This was in December 2008. We hosted 100,000 seats. Then 13 months later, we were up to 1 million. Now we have, I don't know how many, a lot. I think we have, in Finland alone, close to 1 million, and Finland is a country of 6 million people, so it's kind of shows the growth of this. So the topic for today, what we'll cover is, I'll give you an overview of the OneDrive. You probably heard a bunch of overviews, but I still want to level set the things and sort of explain it to you in my terms, what I think OneDrive is important and what it means to my customers. Then I'll go through some of the preparation activities that you should think about, because even though it is a cloud service, it does have some client-side components that actually are quite important to know how to deploy, how to manage them. Then we'll talk a bit about the rollout. So if you're a large organization, how will you roll out the service? So will you just sort of organically let users, or will you do it in a controlled fashion? Just for my curiosity, so how many of you are currently using OneDrive? How many of you have customers currently using OneDrive? How many of you who have customers who are confused between OneDrive and OneDrive for Business? Yeah. So, and then, yeah, it's confusing. And I have a 15-year-old at home, and I try to explain these things to her, and she goes, I don't care. So anyway, it is important, and we kind of heard that feedback loud and clear. So as you kind of... Those of you who have either an Android client or a Windows Phone client, what you've seen is that we've actually starting to merge these clients. So you can expect that we've heard the feedback about the challenge of having two, that we're actually working on that. This session will then end with some talks about how you would address a migration, because one of the things that I hear from a lot of my large enterprise customers is, so how do I then get rid of, let's say, home drives, or how do I, if I have files stored on a competing system like Box or anything else, so how can I then leverage OneDrive? Because if I'm already in the cloud, I get now the unlimited storage, how can I actually benefit and start decommissioning my on-premises servers? I'll talk about some of the things that you need to think about and kind of outline a process that I would follow if I would do a migration for this. So again, why did this happen? So again, it all started from the storage. Everything is digital now. I was in Denmark with my family this summer. Both my wife and my daughter have Lumia 1020s. Great phones. Storage, consume storage like hell. Because the pictures, like 40 megapixel camera, the storage requirements are just growing. So we have the personal storage for kind of a consumer, but then for this audience, we have what is it that the information worker wants? So again, today, most people want a seamless way for them to use their stuff. So again, not having to worry about where is that file, where is this, where and that. So, and also, since we have more and more people with a flexible work style, making sure that you have your files with you wherever you are, which is a good thing, which is sometimes a bad thing. But again, anyway, so this is more or less a given requirement that we need to have this. So, from the individual point of view, people just want things to work. But then there's the other side, which is probably what sort of interests you more here, is that, well, this is all great, but how do we do this in a governed fashion? So how do we ensure that we have data loss protection capabilities? How can we enforce some sort of taxonomies if we want? How can we do those things? And also, it's not just the traditional split where we have the information worker and then we have IT, but what we more and more start to see is that what is it that the business management wants? So again, business management wants to make sure that the intellectual property that people create actually is somewhere that it can be used. Because in most organizations today, I see way too much, like even if they're using SharePoint or any other collaboration product, it tends to be that those documents are in an electronic graveyard. They're stored somewhere, but only if you know where they are, you can actually get value out of them. So one of the bigger drives that we've seen is how can we then provide ways for our customers to make sure that they put their information to use. Anyone go to the Delve session on Tuesday? So Delve combined with OneDrive is actually a really, really cool thing. So I'll have a small slide on Delve, why I think it matters in this question, but with Delve, the beauty is once you get people to start using OneDrive and people start sharing files from there, if you're in the cloud, you get Delve, you actually suddenly start to discover what your peers are working on, your networks are working on, so on and so forth. So the combination to me of OneDrive and Delve is actually the killer combination in the cloud. So what is OneDrive for Business? So at the end of the day, what it does, it provides us a way to securely store your files and share them with your coworkers. Behind the scenes, OneDrive for Business is SharePoint, right? It is the evolution of the SharePoint My Site concept. So your OneDrive for Business document library is actually a document library in your My Site site collection. The other thing that it is, it actually provides sync mechanisms to sync your files to your different devices. So again, we have sync clients for various operating systems, for various platforms. And then, since it is included in SharePoint, we get the search capabilities of SharePoint. And now with Delve, we actually get even richer search capabilities. And then the other thing is that actually it allows us to make sure that it integrates with our identity story. So we don't have to have different username passwords for storing our files somewhere. It's actually seamlessly integrated with our corporate identity. So again, and the other thing again, storage. So and like you heard on Monday, we actually include that we have unlimited storage. It's an interesting thing if you look at it from the point of view that what does unlimited storage mean? And if you combine that with sync, what does that really mean? So people's devices tend not to have unlimited storage. So again, it's an interesting concept, and it's something that we've sort of worked a long time making sure that we can offer that. And we've done really careful studies on how much usage we actually have in there. So like, can we, as a service provider, afford to give you unlimited? Because what if suddenly we have 6 billion people using, well, that's an optimistic approach, but we have a large number of people using OneDrive, and if all start putting everything, what does that cost for us as a service? So this is the reason why we didn't announce unlimited storage when we launched the service like 1.5 years ago, because we've actually monitored, we need to know that we have the scale capacity to grow to do this. And with OneDrive, as with anything kind of Office 365 related, we actually are doing tons of things. So when we started, we had the storage limits of 25 gigs. We allowed customers to purchase storage up to 1 terabyte. So again, you can see here, we were conservative in the sense that since we really didn't know the scale parametrics on cloud level for the system, we sort of moved gradually. And then we started adding capabilities like the shared with view. We added the OneDrive for Business for iOS, versioning, so on and so forth. So, and then we went up from being able to purchase 1 terabyte to actually get 1 terabyte, and now we have the unlimited storage. And then, so we're continuing doing this. So we're adding support for larger and larger files. So again, this is an interesting one because especially the burden it puts on the sync client, because saying that we support unlimited file sizes, we still have to get that file up to the cloud. So the large file support, if you combine large files and dodgy networks, your in for a bumpy ride. But again, that's just laws of physics. It's not the fault of OneDrive. It's not the fault of Dropbox or any other client. If you need to get, let's say, a 10 gigabit file to the cloud, you need to make sure that whatever transport mechanism you use is resilient and it actually can pick up on hiccups in the network. We also announced the data loss protection. We are working on providing selective sync because with unlimited storage without selective sync is kind of a tough thing to solve. So as you see, so this is kind of the roadmap of improvements. So ultimate goal, as you can see on the far right, is to remove all of the known limitations that we have. So, and as I said, the cool thing for me with OneDrive is actually storing stuff in the OneDrive plus combining that then with Delve, because Delve in 365, it mines all the storage it has access to. So documents shared on your OneDrive, documents, emails, stuff like that, and then it actually starts to build this kind of a information graph of content that's relevant to you. So what we've seen for customers, kind of early adapters using this, what you actually find are interesting things, because you start seeing, the first thing that you start to discover is that, well, not all people know how to assign permissions to things. So I remember way back when we launched SharePoint Portal Server 2001 and started indexing file shares. Suddenly we got, hey, I see this HR layoff plan document even though I shouldn't. And why was that? Because in the past, it was hidden in a file share. No one really bothered about looking at what is the actual permissions for things. But now with search mechanisms, we actually are querying things and are starting finding more and more things. And is that the search engine's fault? No, but it just interestingly surfaces things. So this is why like the combination of DLP becomes really, really important. So with DLP, for instance, let's say that I would be a credit card company, and I want to ensure that we don't store any credit card numbers in our storage facilities. So then with DLP, we could apply rules to say that, well, this number series looks very much like a credit card number. Don't allow saving that file, and so on and so forth. So it's like it's interesting in that sense. So if you haven't played with Delve, please do, because it's actually a really cool piece of technology. So that was kind of the overview of all of this. So how do you then prepare for actually doing a OneDrive? So you go to the grocery store, you get paprikas, you get stuff, and you start thinking about recipes, right? So at the end of the day, to me, like, these are some of the things that you need to think about. So again, identity. So since I mentioned that identity is seamlessly tied into your corporate identity, and if you're using the cloud, you have different ways of actually achieving this. So how many of you are on 365 now? A good percentage. How many of you are going to the 365? How many of you don't know but will eventually go? That's the rest of you. So I'll talk about the identity pieces. Then I'll spend some time to talk about the sync client, because this is one of the characters in this play which has a really, really important role, because that is the piece of software that actually behind the scenes does the sync. I'll talk about how to deploy that, how to sort of manage updates and so on. And then I'll talk a bit about some of the findings we've had in an internal project where we are launching, where we moved our consulting services knowledge management repository to the cloud. And we heavily promote like OneDrive for our engagement or project managers so that they can take their project documents with them on the road. But we also want to make sure that we're enforcing the right level of like content types and information architecture in the environment. So we ran into an interesting issue last week, and I'll explain a bit about that in a while. And then we just launched 2 weeks ago a client network bandwidth calculator. This is kind of to help estimate the load of on the network. So again, the interesting thing here is that if we think of a scenario where we, let's say that we have a company that has offices in five places, and we educate our users that, well, now you should move all your documents from your personal home drives into OneDrive. So if all do it at the same time, what is the bandwidth required to do that? Or, so this is kind of important to understand, because if you're planning to do self-service type of migrations, you should actually think about that and then maybe instruct these like town by town or department by department so that you would phase out that, so that you wouldn't throttle your network with just OneDrive traffic. Because as I said, OneDrive is in the cloud. To get the files to the cloud, if you have a terabyte of data, you need to get a terabyte of data to the cloud. There's no magic bullet. And we can't do anything else except use TCP level transports to actually get that stuff there. So the more files, the bigger files, the longer it'll take. So identity options. So we have, as you all know, we have actually, in a way, two ways of looking at identity and in the Azure Active Directory. So we have the cloud identities, which are AD objects, but who are that are stored as usernames and passwords are stored in the cloud. Then we have the single identity with directory or password synchronization. This means that we have one identity in the cloud, but what we do sync from the on-premises environment is a password hash. So you can log on using the same credentials to the cloud, but those credentials are not validated to your on-premises environment. And then the one which I see most, if not all of my enterprise customers are using, is the federated identity, which means that we actually have the same identity both in the cloud and in on-premises. So, and again, why did we create the Azure Active Directory? So that we have a directory that supports our products in the cloud. So if we think of 365, at the end of the day, 365 is still, there's Exchange Server, there's Link, there's SharePoint, we have a SQL Server backend, we have this and that. And most of our server products are so tightly connected to an AD, so you can't deploy a SharePoint environment without AD. You cannot deploy Exchange without an AD. So that's why we have like the Active Directory in the cloud to support these services as well. And at the same time, we then get the identity store for all our cloud users. So what it does for you guys is actually it allows us to get the single sign-on experience so that we can build a seamless integration between our on-premises environment and our cloud environment. And also the fact that we can then do multi-factor authentication for those clients or for those kind of operations that support that. So you can, as you've probably seen in some other demos, we can now do like login using your phone, for instance. So the system actually calls, sends you a text message with a code and then you use that to log in. So you can make sure that you're not just authenticating using username, password, you can use alternative means as well. One other thing that I want to point out with the multi-factor authentication, it's typically easy to do for platforms that understand that. And by that, I mean browsers or anything that can understand if I get a redirect or doing something else. The challenge is if I'm using the Office client, for instance, so and try to access a resource, how can the Office client handle these things? So you might see cases where you're required to access the environment first using a browser and then after that using the client. But again, this has been the same way for a long, long time. So let's actually dig a bit deeper into the different identities. So with the cloud identity, we have Bob who is in Office 365. So behind the scenes, what we have then is that Bob's identity is stored in the Windows Azure Active Directory. We have interfaces for getting programmatically data into it. We have like the new interfaces for OAuth. We can talk SAML, we have federation. But then what this enables us is then in 365 to have the experience that we have. So we have the admin portal, which Bob can log on to. We have the activation services, we have mailbox, we have SharePoint, we have Link, we have this, we have that. But behind the scenes, Bob exists in the Windows Active Directory, Azure Active Directory as a user. So how does this then change when we come move forward? So one of the things, if you're doing this, so there's multiple ways of getting data into it, and a simple one could be just PowerShell and import stuff from CSVs. But again, as I said, this one I see for small organizations that don't really have an IT department or they don't even have an Active Directory. So it would be, let's say I'm a startup that's starting to do things. This would be an easy way for me to do all that management. And then you combine this with things like Intune. you get desktop management, so on and so forth. But again, as I said, I think most of you guys are here more interested on the higher end solutions like using DirSync and using then Federation. How many of you, by the way, are using Federation in 365? Is anyone of you using DirSync with password sync? Sorry? And Federation, okay. So, directory synchronization, it's surprisingly simple thing, but in many of my 365 deployment projects, this was actually a quite daunting task to get done. Reason for this is that we actually, in Azure Active Directory, we have quite strict requirements on the data quality of your AD. And what we've seen, unfortunately, in many projects, is that the on-premises Active Directory is not up to date. Like the data quality is not what it should be. So one of the things that we've seen in many of our 365 deployments is that we have to start with a remediation project where we actually clean up the local on-premises AD. So one of the typical things that we need to do is that most customers today still log on to their machines using domain / user, whereas in the cloud, you're using the user principal name. So we have a large number of customers who didn't really populate the UPN in their AD because they didn't need that. But again, if you're going to the cloud, this is one of the key metrics that you need to have in place. So in essence, what directory synchronization does for us, it provides the integration between the Azure Active Directory and your on-premises AD by replicating the users, the groups, and the contacts to the cloud. So, and it's a FIM-based solution, and it actually is intelligent enough so that it also knows to pick up all modifications, additions, all changes. So it is, for all intents and purposes, an appliance that once you install it, it just runs and does things. You don't typically have to worry about much of that. So what it allows us to then do is making sure that we have the same named identities across both sides. So what about then, but it does not synchronize, for instance, we don't by default synchronize anything else but the user data. So you can, when you install DirSync, you can also enable password synchronization. What does that allow us? Well, it extends the solution to provide a somewhat single sign-on experience. It's not a real single sign-on. It allows us, since we're synchronizing the hash of your password, it allows the Azure Active Directory to, when you're doing a logon, that you're using the same username and password that you're using on-premises. Because behind the scenes, like the validation is always done against the hash of the password. So we can ensure that you are sort of logging on using the same username and password. And if you have DirSync enabled, by default, directory synchronizations happen on a regular schedule, but whenever there's a password change happening, notification, that actually initiates an immediate sync. So if you're doing a password change on premises, it might take a minute or two, but it shouldn't take longer than that to have that password in place in the cloud as well. So again, this lowers the sort of a barrier to entry for organizations that don't want to deploy Federation. Because again, one of the key components in a enterprise 365 deployment on the on-premises side is the Federation infrastructure. You need to make sure that environment is fault tolerant. So typical enterprise deployment of ADFS has five machines. So you have a SQL backend, you have two ADFS servers, and you have two proxies. So that is the recommended topology for ADFS. So again, with DirSync and password sync, you can actually get away with just one machine. So for smaller organizations, this actually is a very viable option. And again, this doesn't require adding the Federation services, so it has a lower cost. What it does not do is provide real single sign-on, in the sense that you will have to authenticate against the cloud, but you're authenticating with the same username and password. So for most people, that kind of is, well, it's the same credentials. I just get another authentication prompt. So they're all happy in the sense that I don't have to remember another password. It is the same password. This does not support any of the custom two-factor authentications because, again, all authentication happens on the server side against the Active Directory Azure. So it is, in a way, a single point of failure because if the DIR sync and your password syncs fail, your new passwords won't get synced to the cloud. So again, if you're deploying this, make sure that you have the right monitoring in place so that you can ensure that your passwords flow across nicely. So what does this mean? So for DIR sync, we actually deploy a server in the environment. It's, as I said, it is an appliance using FIM. So we have a FIM machine running, and it actually then connects to your on-premises Active Directory, and it knows all the changes, modifications, also, and then it synchronizes these objects up to the Azure Active Directory. So, and then if you add, when you're installing, there's a check that do you want to enable password sync. It's the same process, you just enable that with one click. Then, where it becomes interesting for me is when we actually start then to talk for federation. So, federation is the way that we can ensure that all authentication traffic is actually done against your on-premises Active Directory. So you're not authenticating against the Azure Active Directory, but you're actually transferred back to your on-premises ADFS infrastructure so that authentication always happens against your on-premises environment. So if you look at where does this fit in the picture, so since we register the domains in 365, and if we're using Federation, we actually tell the Office 365 Federation Gateway that if someone is coming in with a user principal name at joeuser@contoso.com, we know that contoso.com needs to be authenticated here. So the way that we do this, because if you think of it, the only information that you provide when you're accessing the first logon page in the cloud is, please provide your username, and then when you start typing your username and the thing after the at symbol, oh, we know that, hey, contoso.com is a federated customer, please go to Contoso's ADFS to do this. So we're, in a way, we're offloading the authentication back to the customer side. And so this is why, and most of the enterprises that I work want to have this control, because then it's up to you to figure out, like, if you have alternative ways or additional things that you need to do as part of the authentication process. So that's kind of the back-end infrastructure. So what about then the client side? Because there are, as I mentioned in the beginning, there's a connection for the OneDrive for Business, the SharePoint site, and then how do we do the sync? So at the end of the day, what we have behind the scenes is the sync client. So there's two ways to deploy it. So if you're if you get Office 365 and the Office clients as part of your 365 subscription, and if you're using the Click to Run installation technology, you will get it automatically as part of that. So it'll install a component on your machine that you can that gives you then the capability of doing the OneDrive for Business sync. You can also install it separately. So we've had some customers who are running an older version of Office but want to use OneDrive for Business, so it's possible as well, and I'll talk about that in a short while. So this is one of the things why I prefer, if possible, to go with a Click to Run, because we are improving the sync client quite frequently. So if you're doing a Click to Run deployment, you actually can, you'll get those updates kind of automatically behind the scenes. So you don't really know that you're updating, but it's just doing things behind the scenes. And some of the other cool things with Click to Run is that, again, your users do not need to be local administrators to do upgrades. So Click to Run is done in a way that you can be doing updates using sort of a user rights. But again, all of these can also be controlled by group policies. So for larger enterprises, you can use the Office deployment tool for managed deployment. So you could say that we download the bits to the sort of to these deployment servers. We control the, so IT can take charge of controlling the updates to the sync client as well. So some of the the kind of information architecture planning things that I usually talk about with regards to OneDrive is that, first of all, we do support more than just synchronizing your My site. So OneDrive actually supports synchronizing any SharePoint team site. So if you do that, what you will see on your PC is that you have a folder which is so like OneDrive for business for contoso.com, and then you have another folder called SharePoint. So, and underneath the SharePoint folder, the sync client will create folders for each of the document libraries that you sync from team sites. So there's some software boundaries that are also important to know, and this is where the kind of unlimited storage versus limits kind of gets a bit iffy. So we only support today syncing up to 20,000 items from your sort of a personal site. So that's the limit of the client. The limit for team sites is 5,000 items. And I could make the argument that it's probably not a good information architecture design to keep like 5,000 documents per library. It probably makes more sense to have multiple libraries. But these are just things that you need to be mindful of, that if you have, you might run into these things. The thing that stumped us in our internal project last week was the one with an asterisk, the 12 lookup column list. So the sync client, actually, when it talks to SharePoint, it understands the schema, it understands like which type of if it, rich text, so on and so forth. It doesn't really do much with the metadata, but it actually looks at the schema of the list. And there is a limitation in 365 that the sync client only supports synchronizing 12 lookup columns in a list. So again, this is typically not a problem for most customers, but for customers like our consulting services, we have a very stringent taxonomy on how we classify our documents. So we have a lot of managed terms in our document libraries. So this 12-column lookup list is interesting in the sense because you would think that a lookup column is, oh, it's just the field type lookup, but actually it's not. So lookup column is either of type lookup. It could be any of the user columns are actually lookup columns behind the scenes. So if I have my created by and modified by fields, those are lookup fields. Every time you add a managed metadata field, you add a lookup field. So, and if you have versioning with checkout and required, you're adding a lookup field. So in essence, what this means is that out of those 12, in a default library, you're already consuming 3. Right, so you have created by, modified by, and checked out too. So you have 9 metadata columns at maximum. So that's what we thought. because I said we have quite strict requirements on taxonomy, so we actually were using 9 metadata fields. But suddenly we had issues where this library was syncing, the other one was not. We couldn't understand like what's going on. So we had a long troubleshooting call, and then what we discovered is, and we actually are in the process of updating KB article, is that if you share a document in a document library, the way that that is implemented is by adding a multi-choice user field. Again, it makes tons of sense because then you can, at that list item, see that this item is shared with Joe, Bob, and Phil. So then when you look at the properties, you can directly see that. But that's implemented as a lookup field. So that was the problem. We had this library that worked, we hadn't shared it. The other one that didn't work, we had shared, and like we were stumped, like the support was stumped, but now we know. So actually what this means is that if you're planning to do sharing, you need to sort of make know that that actually consumes one of those lookup columns. The final thing here, again, currently we have no selective sync, which again is interesting in the sense that, like, I got an interesting call from my manager. He said that someone says that I've deleted their entire document library in SharePoint. I said, okay, Jeff, what did you do? So he told me, well, actually, I'm part of that team, and we're actually working on this proposal, and I wanted to sync this folder, so a subfolder in the library. So he went, he was navigating SharePoint, was in that folder, clicked sync. Little did he know that actually when you're doing that, we don't sync per folder, we sync per list or per library level. So we actually synchronize the full library. And then in the client said, oh, I don't need this anymore. Again, remember, sync is two ways. So he gladly deleted the site and then he got a mail. So hang on, where's that library? And the good thing here, or bad thing, depending on point of view, is that our recycle bin capabilities are quite good. So then the site owner called Jeff. So why the heck did you go and delete our old proposals library? And Jeff was like, I did not, but the log shows. So again, mindful here, when you're doing a sync, it is the entire library. You can't do per folder. The other thing is, make sure that you plan your permissions correctly, because it's way too easy for someone to do what my manager did. Oh, I don't need this library anymore. So instead of stopping the sync, like you should do in the sync client, say that stop synchronizing this list or library, he went to the folder in your PC and just deleted. Again, since deletions, it's a sync operation, right? So then he deleted, boom, everything went away. Luckily, we were able to restore everything from the recycle bin. So the other thing that I mentioned, we launched the Excel sheet that we can use to calculate the network bandwidth requirements. And again, so this is in a way just simple mathematics, in the sense that because if we know how much content we have, we know how much data we need to move across the wire. But this is just designed sort of to simplify kind of the reporting. So if we assume in this case that a working day is 8 hours, we have like a network pipe of X, we have files of this side, we create or modify that many files, so then how much network does OneDrive consume? So again, it's simple mathematics, but it's actually really useful to when you're doing the network planning. And one of the tasks that we always I found really interesting in the Office 365 deployments was the network planning piece, because we oftentimes I have, as I said, a long SharePoint background. We quite often focused on looking, so does the bandwidth support SharePoint usage? But we quite often forgot to see, well, now with Link, it's actually SharePoint and Exchange are lightweight on the network. Link is actually the one who's really consuming bandwidth in the network. But well, I would say it's Link. It's the sync client when you do the rollout. So after you've synced, but once you've sort of synced everything in steady state, like the sync client is not heavy. But Link is interesting because Link, as you know, if I'm talking to Bob, it's a peer-to-peer connection. But if we invite Phil into that discussion, then the traffic goes via the server. And the other thing that Link is really consuming network is when you start sharing desktop. And it's understandable, because what needs to happen then, like we need to transmit the information so that the desktop can be rendered on the other Link clients. So I've been trying to educate my team that please don't share the desktop, upload the PowerPoint to Link. But people go, oh, let me share my desktop. And then they have like these big screens and then like a lot of stuff flashing on, wondering why Link is slow. So anyway, again, this is a good tool to have to kind of get an initial estimate on what will be the load on your environment. So how do we roll out OneDrive? So as I said, like one of the first thing to think about is it starts as everything. And all the journey starts with the first step. And the first step with regards to OneDrive is making sure that you assign the user a SharePoint license. Because without a SharePoint license, there is no object that SharePoint can create. There is no OneDrive for that person. So you have to have it start. But again, most of the customers that I work, like it's kind of a, they sort of a, automatically deploy the license. But if you're a customer who just want to use OneDrive, you need to make sure that you have the SharePoint license and you assign that. And then the second thing is, again, as I said, behind the scenes, OneDrive connects to your My site. So you need to make sure that that personal site or the OneDrive for business site is created. And then the third thing is the sync client. And you get that either by installing the full Office 2013 or just the sync client. So how do you get the OneDrive sites then? So the normal way that we usually recommend is creating them organically. So when a user interacts either via Office 365 or the Office client, let the sites be created then when I need them. So, but there are cases where you actually want to sort of pre-create them. So like, again, if we're thinking of the scenario, if I'm migrating my home drives, then in order for me to migrate anything to a OneDrive site, the OneDrive site needs to exist. So there are cases where we want to pre-create them. The pre-creation is an interesting one, and I'll have a couple of slides on that, because that is, creating the OneDrive for business site is one of the most heavy operations on SharePoint Online today, because there's a lot of infrastructure behind the scenes that gets involved when you're creating the my site. That's why if you have, so we had, for instance, we had an education sector customer for whom we needed to create, I think, 100,000 OneDrive sites for their students. It actually took a really, 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 really long time when we had that, and this was like 15 months ago. So that was when we realized that we actually have to work and making improvements in the pipeline that we use to create personal sites. So we've made a lot of improvements. It's still not the quickest operation, but it's much, much better than it used to be. So the sync client, as I mentioned, you can use the Office deployment tool, which is actually a console application and configuration file. So this is the way that you would download the necessary bits. So the interesting thing here is actually, you can see here, product ID Groove. So the sync client is actually what's left of the Groove client. So we've taken the Groove technology and that's the foundation of the sync client. So the product Groove Retail, so in the configuration here, so you said that I'm downloading the bits, I'm using the configuration file, and it then says like which client version to which file share am I downloading, and so on and so forth. And then the counterpart then for installation, you again use the Office deployment tool, use the configuration file, and then push out, say that, well, you run this and the installation, instead of downloading from the web, you get them from here. And in the first version that we had for this, like, we did not support DFS paths. So you actually had just one server from which you could install. And of course, for global customers, having everyone going back to this one server to get the bits was not optimal. So today we support actually having multiple endpoints, so that if you have users across all continents, you could have distribution points closer to them. So the other interesting thing here is that updates enabled true in this case, so it means that we can configure the client so that it knows when to upgrade and it knows how to upgrade itself. So the easiest way, again, is to have updates enabled true and nothing else. Then the client actually checks, calls home to Microsoft to see is there a newer client and checks that. But you could also do what we have here, like in the configuration file, you specify the path to where my bits are. So again, this is a case where you don't want your end users to go and download stuff from the web, but you actually want to do that in a more controlled fashion. Then you can also say that we actually don't support updates, we just have, like, we're doing do a build. So again, same here, you can specify which versions you want, and like this, as you see here, like 15.0.x.x. So you can really clearly control what version you have. So again, my recommendation, if possible, use the click to runs and keep the automatic updates enabled, because as I said, we are quite frequently releasing fixes and updates to the sync client. So if you want to maintain it yourself, just make sure that you are then up to date with all the changes that we're doing. So then how would you address migrations? So again, for migrations, there's essentially three options that I see for OneDrive for Business. So it's the self-directed, by which I'm advising or telling or my users that, hey, so we've created your OneDrive for Business site. you have this folder in your on your PC. Please drag and drop the files that you want to the cloud to this. And again, that thing could partially be done using a GPO or logon or something like that if we can easily map that, like user X home drive is here. So we could automate that partially. But again, if we automate that, we have to remember that, let's say we have 1,000 users who are running the script at the same time, and each 1,000 users has 100 gigabytes of content, then it means a lot of content needs to go up to the cloud. My mathematics this early is not my strong point. So anyway, so again, be mindful of the fact, remember laws of physics apply here. So if you have a lot of data that you need to move to the cloud, make sure that you stage them in steps. So the other option that I have also kind of seen very much is having an IT-driven bulk upload. So like using instead of having the end users copy, providing them with a tool that actually goes and does things. So, and then the tool could be, the second one is kind of more focused around files, because at the end of the day, even though the OneDrive for Business site is a full my site in essence, most users only care about the files. When we've done studies on the usage of my sites, it's very few people who have like custom lists or anything like that in their my sites. So, and then the third one would be that having full broad, like using some of the migration tools. So if you're, let's say, moving from a competing platform like Dropbox or Google Drive or something like that, then we have migration vendors some of them are here even, who have tools for doing that. But what I've seen in many cases, most cost efficient one is the first one. You just tell your users, please do this. And this is actually how Microsoft, when we did the migration of our personal sites into the cloud, we got an ultimatum from our IT, said that, well, your current personal sites will be up and running for 3 months. Please make sure that you copy all the stuff that you need into the cloud. Most customers that I work with, their users would not accept that, but Microsoft is a special company in many ways. So we have an IT department that just says, oh, this is your option. The options are A. Can I choose? Yes, as long as you choose A. It's kind of a Henry Fordian. You can have the car of any color as long as it's black, right? So again, for migrations, the other thing kind of to think about then, if we're doing a managed migration of personal content, so as I said, then we need to make sure that personal site already exists. So we need to be able to pre-provision them somehow, but we also need to make sure that we have an account that has the rights to actually create content on your personal site, because by default, the name personal means that it's your personal. So when we're creating a OneDrive for Business or a personal site, it is your site. You're the one who has the permissions there. No one else has permissions to actually upload stuff there. So if you're doing a migration, you need to make sure that you're assigning permissions to a migration account, and then once the migration is completed, you probably should remove those permissions from that account. So, and we didn't support programmatic ways of creating OneDrive sites before SP1. So again, as I mentioned, we had the education customer for who we had to create these hundreds of thousands of my sites. That work led to a lot of the improvements in that space that we did for SP1. So if you're planning to do bulk provisioning, the way our APIs today actually are not doing the creation directly, but your request to create a personal site is put into a queue. And at the moment, the maximum queue size for a batch is 200. So if you're trying to, let's say, put in 250, we'll only process the 200 first one. And the queue is actually shared by the tenants. So if you have number of, and this is the interesting thing, because you don't know who else is in the same physical SharePoint farm. Because why should you know? Because it's a software as a service. But what may happen is that what if you have then for, like, as an academic exercise, you have five tenants on that server, and all five of them are, oh, let's pre-create their personal sites. So that's why we cannot really guarantee the throughput for creating a personal site, because, again, we're sharing the queue amongst all the tenants. But what our goal is to have like 95% of those sites created in a quite short time frame. But again, we cannot guarantee that because we don't know the particular behavior. So it is possible that our service starts throttling if a single tenant is constantly pumping things into the queue. So again, if you're planning to do the rollout, I would advise to have not to an ambitious timeline, rather doing them like if we need that. If you say, let's say your deadline is it need to be done by this, so don't wait until the last moment and think, oh, we can do it quickly. Start provisioning them early and in a smaller chunks. So and as I said, since we share the queue amongst different tenants, the provisioning speed depends on what's going on. So it also depends, like, we upgrade in the environment quite frequently. So every 2 weeks, we're rolling things into the environment. So again, those things might have an impact. So in a nutshell, the key thing is make sure that you're sort of you take this into account in your project plans if you're doing this. So the next slide is showing how you would use the client-side object model to do this. So we have this create personal sites NQ bulk method that actually takes a list of user principal names, and then it has the maximum of 12. The funny thing, it is actually user principal names, but even our developers confuse user principal names with emails. In many cases, our recommendation is to keep your user principal name to be the same as your email, because it's easier for people to remember, but there's no requirements to do that. So anyway, this is the way that you could programmatically create them using CSUM. If you want to use PowerShell, this is the way that you would use Reflection and load the client user profiles assembly. So in order to use this, you need to download the SharePoint client object model redistributable component. So you would load that assembly, you would get the profile loader, and then call the queue here. So as you said, in this case, we would create job user at Contoso. And then when we call the execute query, this would be put into the queue. And then we would process it as quickly as we can. But again, it's a queue, so so your migration mechanism, if you're doing everything like programmatically, you cannot expect that directly that you come back from calling this function that the personal site would be there. So, because again, it gets put in the queue. So if you're doing migrations, you call this, and then you need to have a mechanism then to check if this site exists before you're trying to start to pump content into it. So this is how you would assign the permissions, again, using the PowerShell from the client side. So you would, the interesting thing here is actually in this particular example, I'm using both the Office 365 PowerShell and the SharePoint Online PowerShell. So I get the credentials, I'm connecting to the SharePoint service, but I'm also connecting to Active Directory, to Azure Active Directory. And in this case, I say that my migration account is migration account at Contoso. I go and get all of the users, and then for each, it doesn't really show, the slide doesn't scroll nicely. Let me see if I can. Anyway, in this, what I would do here is I'm actually looping through and getting all of the sites. So as you almost can see on the slide, that the site URL is Contoso, and then my SharePoint /personal, and then /the prefix of the UPN. And then I would just get that site using the SharePoint Online PowerShell, and then I would do a set SPO site user, and I would add the migration account to it. So you can do everything scriptable, which is really, really good. We couldn't do this before SP1. So these are some of the improvements that we made in the service. So if we then start to think about, so what are the steps involved if I would do a home drive migration? So again, with all migrations, it starts with an assessment. So let's say that I'm doing a I want to decommission my home drivers. So the first thing I would need to know is, okay, so how many users do I have? So our query would probably be identifying all of the enabled users in AD, then seeing is there, like, some customers actually populate the home drive locations to AD, but somehow we need to figure out of these active users, what is the path to their home drive. We probably would do some level of assessment, and for instance, what is the size, what are the file types, and things like that. And size matters here because, again, the bigger the home drive, the longer it'll take to synchronize the content across. File types, it does matter because even though OneDrive for Business supports almost all file types and it supports up to 10 gigabyte size file sizes, not everything should go there. So if you have, like, let's say I had, now this is many, many years ago, I had a customer, this was SharePoint 2007, he wanted to decommission all of their file shares and put everything into SharePoint. But they had file shares that contained SQL databases, so MDF files and LDF files. So there's things that should not go into SharePoint. So running a SQL database from a SharePoint library, bad idea, extremely bad idea. So you need to do some level of assessment to figure out, like, what content is meant to be stored in OneDrive and what's meant to be stored on all file shares or somewhere else. So again, doing some level of assessment so that you understand what you have there. And then the next thing would be, again, based on if you know your user distribution, you know the sizes of their home drives, plan the scheduling. So whose personal drives will be migrated this day, whose will be migrated the next day, so that your migration batch sizes are reasonable. And then when you do the actual migration, make sure that whatever you do, whatever tool you use to migrate against the cloud is actually fault tolerant. Because what I see, I was actually involved in migrating our knowledge management environment to the cloud, and this was a terabyte of data in 37,000 site collections. So I had my tools running like 24/7, and one thing that's guaranteed is you cannot run 24/7 without hiccups. The hiccups might be anything related, a network hiccup, it might be an ADFS hiccup. So make sure that whatever tool you have is resilient and knows how to pick up in case of failure. So kind of to illustrate this in other steps, so how would the migration process be? We would start from the AD, we would populate the information from AD into a queue somewhere so that we know we have 5,000 users, we store that queue somewhere. We then go and fetch the data or package the data or whatever way we choose from the file servers. We then transform the information and move that to SharePoint, and then notify the migration workstation back that, well, this batch is done. And then finally, we would then remove the permissions from the migration account. So very straightforward process, and we are in talks with many customers who are thinking about it. So out of curiosity, how many of you are thinking about replacing your home drives or have customers who are thinking about replacing their home drives with OneDrive? That was what I was afraid of or wanted to hear. So yeah, does this process make sense? Because I think so. It should be something like this. So again, because the challenge that I've seen with migrations of content into the cloud is the fact that you are moving stuff into the cloud. So in the past, so we have, if we think of like the cloud services that we offer, the dedicated platform and the multi-tenant platform, in the past, we allowed our dedicated customers to ship us databases so that we could actually then attach them. And what makes this sometimes confusing is that Azure team supports us sending databases that we can attach to Azure, but SharePoint does not. So like the only way of getting content into the cloud is by using the remote APIs. So just be mindful of it. So kind of some of the best practices for migration. Again, keep it simple. For OneDrive migrations, it works best when it's content centric. So if it's files, right? Ideally, if you don't care about modification dates, a simple way of copying stuff into the OneDrive folder on your PC and letting the sync client handle that is an easy way to do this. But if you actually care about metadata, and if you want to maintain like the created dates or modification dates, then you have to use some level of tooling that can actually programmatically push the files into SharePoint and then set the right metadata. So it's we have APIs that support that, but again, all of those things add complexity. The other key thing is making sure that you have realistic expectations for throughput, because the thing that we, as I said, your farm may actually have, most likely your farm will contain other users' SharePoint environments as well. So, and we, like, there's no way of knowing what the other guys are doing. So being realistic and like, just because your average throughput today was, let's say, a gigabyte per hour, doesn't mean that it's a gigabyte per hour tomorrow. It could be two, it could be half of it. So be mindful of that. And expect errors. Make sure that, as I said, make sure that whatever you do is that you can run it again so that it picks up and resumes where it fails, because things will happen. So things will happen. Like if you're doing programming using the client-side object model, a thing that I've seen quite often happening, so I have a connection to SharePoint Online, I start processing things, but then at one point of time, like the network load balancing in front of it actually pushes me to another web front end. So the thing that happens today with the client-side object model is that it actually expects the connection to stay alive. So when I get transferred on the back end to the other, I get an exception in my code. So again, making sure that you plan for those things and write them. So I wanted to quickly share some of the things that we, so internally, like we're in Microsoft, we're promoting OneDrive quite heavily. So I'm part of the Microsoft Services organization. So we actually moved our entire collaboration platform into the cloud. So we have 24,000 people. We have like 500,000 IP artifacts. So we store all our project-related content. We do most of our collaboration actually in our team sites. We actually manage, we have 92 communities of practice who we operate within, all within the SharePoint platform. And it's now all moved to the cloud. So we have, everything is running in the tenant. So we get the same benefits as all the cloud customers get. So the fact that it is a team site, I get the OneDrive, I get the sync to the client. The interesting thing for us, which I hope that you're not in the same situation, is the fact that we're actually sub-tenants in our tenant. So it is the Microsoft IT organization that manages our SharePoint installation. We, as MCS, have no management permissions whatsoever into the environment. So what does this mean? Well, it means that, for instance, all of our, if we need to do any changes on things like manage metadata, we have to go through change management processes. So it actually made our life quite complex. But our ultimate goal is, again, to leverage OneDrive heavily and then build things upon the Office Graph. Because you can imagine one of the big challenges for any consulting organization is how can we actually take those IP artifacts that are created by people and make them discoverable? Because even though it's fun to reinvent the wheel, it's more sort of a lucrative to actually use someone else's wheel. So anyway, so this is just to show you that like we are heavily believing in the OneDrive story internally. So again, once, like most of these sessions have already happened, so if you do time travel, you could go back in time to watch this, or alternatively, you could wait until you get the materials from TechEd. So to me, these three ones are the most relevant with regards to this session. So it is the overview session, the collaborating in the cloud across devices, and then the Delve one. So that's all from me. So if there's any questions, please use the microphone so that we can get the recording, because I'm lousy at remembering what you ask. I don't remember to repeat the question. So please use the mics. Yes?
Hi. I've seen you use the word be realistic in a few things. So I'm at a loss here because you talk about 27,000 people moving home drives to OneDrive. I've got small sites with 20 people and my, you know, lots of them, and my help desk degenerated into people just ringing absolutely all the time because the OneDrive app simply does not work. I mean, absolutely does not work.
Yes.
There's no login. There's not even any way of finding out what happened.
Yes.
So we migrated terabytes of stuff there. And what we have now is contacting support and they say, oh, how about your recache? How many times do you guys expect me to recache this stuff? So to all these people that raised their hand when they're considering this, I would say that, for example, when you're thinking of bandwidth, multiply by 1,000 because you're going to be doing this absolutely every single freaking day. Yep. And you guys don't even seem to know what's going on. And I come to TechEd, and you guys just give this rosy picture, and it's just a farce. Sorry, man. It's a farce.
Yeah, so I don't know how to comment that. But
another thing you may want to try is ask for a show of hands here of who actually knows what I'm talking about. There you go. There you go.
Yep. So
it's a farce.
It has potential. We're not there yet. So not being part of the product group, it's kind of hard for me to commit on timelines. So yes, it's been a really bumpy ride. We've had tons of issues with the sync client. So this is, again, one of the reasons why in our engineering teams we're pouring in tons of resources to fix this. So this is why, like, you see quite frequent upgrades to the sync client. You see quite frequently upgrades to the backend infrastructure. So we are painfully aware of the fact that it's not doing what we want today. But our goal is, and we know this, the goal is actually to make it work.
That's fine, man. But see, from a planning point of view, what we want to know is actually we want to hear that up front. We don't want to come here and get this rosy picture saying, hey, go ahead. We've just done this terabytes because at the moment it doesn't work. And none of you are admitting to that. You're actually telling us, go ahead and do this. And it just doesn't work. So maybe you should say, this will work in a few months. Maybe you should say things like that.
Well, we do have customers on it where it does work. We have the same thing. It works internally for us. So does it work? Is it a rosy story? No. Is it ugly today? Yes. But we are making sure that, like, this is why we have the feedback. This is one of the reasons why we have these things, and that's why we have a OneDrive booth at the showcase floor to get that feedback. And we've heard it loud and clear. This isn't ready for enterprises. But this does not mean, so like this, if you remember the slide where so the improvements and the pace of change, we are working on that. Is it perfect today? No. Will it get better? Yes. Will it be perfect eventually? Sorry, that's the best answer I can give to that. But anyway, so it is one of those things where there's inherent challenges in any kind of a sync solution where you're synchronizing from the cloud to the client. Are we getting better? Yes. Are we there yet? No.
I have completely another question and probably a little bit go away from the previous comment. I'm in SharePoint since a couple of years, and the vision was go away from folder structures, go to metadata.
Yes.
And in Workspace, it's worked. How do we suppose to do this in OneDrive? Because as you guys, you have document libraries that are metadata driven, no folders at all. You sync it to OneDrive and you see thousands of documents without the ability to navigate.
Yes. We at the moment, since we don't, the OneDrive client, essentially, since it just synchronizes the files themselves. And like the challenge here is that there's no correlation between the schema in SharePoint and the schema of what we could have in the file system, right? So the only way here is, the only thing that we can do with the current file systems, and this is true across platforms, is that the only thing that we know that we can do is the file with the title and so on and so forth, which is, I agree, from knowledge management point of view, this is bad. because like if you have organizations that are enforcing taxonomies, enforcing like metadata, there's no way today that if you just add a document into your OneDrive, it gets synced, but then if you have mandatory metadata, you would have to go into the browser and to fill them up. It is a challenge, so. But if we think of it so, like, the OneDrive story is, it's very much, if we think of the traditional information worker story, so again, it meets the needs of like the 80 to 85, the 15% makes it challenging. So I don't know of any concrete plans today to sort of add the metadata things into the client, because the challenge would be how do we implement that on Android, on iOS, on Mac, so on and so forth. So I'm afraid that's not a good story either. So any other questions? All right, with that, thanks very much. And then let me do this.